Blog Talk Radio.
This is Chi-Town Chatter with Matt Peck.
Short to drive, King, fire, get out! He scores! The Bulls lead 87-86!
Who's trying to get open? Fires away! Fire! It's over! The Bulls win it at the buzzer!
I live the way I live. I eat the things I eat, and I'll die the way I'll die.
Jay Cutler is finally starting to exercise some of the demons of his past. Donald Trump wants to build a wall, everybody. Maybe he can just make one out of Corey Crawford.
That doesn't make sense.
I swear I've seen a lot of stuff in my life, but that was...
What's up, Chicago? Welcome in to another edition of Chi-Town Chatter on Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Matt Peck. Happy to have you with me tonight. You can also follow me on Twitter at MMP underscore DA. That's MMP underscore DAAA. Like and follow the Facebook page, Chi-Town Chatter with Matt Peck. For pictures, follow on Instagram at Chi-Town Chatter. If you want to listen to me, well, I should say, if you want to read me bitching about the Bulls, making fun of the Bulls, catch all of my Bulls columns at sportsmockery.com. For all of my previous podcasts and content, check out my website, www.chitownchatter.com. Chi-Town Chatter is brought to you by Benny's Beverage Depot. Remember, if you can't find it at Benny's, it's probably not worth drinking. Happy Friday. Beautiful day here on the north side as the Cubbies get a 6-0 win over the Arizona Diamondbacks at Wrigley Field. John Lackey, stellar on the mound, pitching 6 2/3 innings, striking out 9, walking 2, giving up 5 hits, but no runs. And the Cubbies using a massive 5-run 8th inning to put that game away. Two more games in this homestand for the Cubs after sweeping the Phillies and taking 3 of 4 against the Dodgers. The Cubs have won 9 of their last 10. How about this production that we've been getting from the Cubs starting rotation? And yet people keep talking about the possibility of Theo Epstein adding a significant starting pitcher to the rotation at the trade deadline. Does this Cubs really need? We'll talk about it. We've got a great weekend of sports on deck. In tennis, Serena Williams looking for her 22nd Grand Slam title in the women's final of the French Open tomorrow morning. I believe that's 8 a.m. Central Time. Novak Djokovic will try for his career Grand Slam, the French Open, the only major he has yet to win. Standing in his way is Andy Murray of England, the first British player to reach the French Open final since 1937. Djokovic and Murray will square off in the men's final on Sunday. Tomorrow night, Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals, Pittsburgh Penguins have a 2-0 lead over the San Jose Sharks after they get a dramatic overtime victory in Game 2. Sid the Kid, Sidney Crosby, a clutch face-off win to set up that game-winning goal. Sunday night, Game 2 of the NBA Finals. Warriors taking Game 1 last night, beating the Cavs fairly easily, 104-89, the final score. Who should Bulls fans be rooting for? And do the Cavaliers still have a chance after last night's loss? You look at the numbers, you look at the box score, and you watch that game from last night, and things aren't really looking that promising for the Cavs, but there is that X factor, LeBron James. And Copa America Centenario kicks off tonight, U.S. men's national team hosting the number 4 world-ranked Colombian squad in the first game of their group stage. That game is at Levi Stadium out on the West Coast. Kickoff at 8:30 Central Time. Who will the key players be for the U.S. men in this tournament? And what are the realistic expectations for Jurgen Klinsmann's squad? We'll dish on that, too, as we have open phone lines tonight, 347-327-9183. And let's begin with the Cubbies. 6-0 win over the D-backs today, 9 of the last 10. First, we have to talk about the game that Javi Baez had yesterday and the addition to that stellar performance that he gave just a couple hours ago. Javi Baez is playing some great baseball.
That boy is good.
Today, he was just 1 of 4 in the batter's box with 3 strikeouts, but that one hit was a big one, a 2-run double in that big 5-run 8th inning the Cubs had. And Baez, after bringing home his runners, actually found his own way to home to the plate after a error in the field by Arizona. So Baez accounting for 3 of the Cubs' 6 runs today. And yesterday he was 2 of 4 at the plate with 3 RBI, including a 2-run homer that extended the Cubs' lead to a comfortable 4-0 in the 4th inning on their way to that 7-2 victory in the series finale against the Dodgers. And just as impressive as the homer yesterday and the RBI double today is the plays he's making in the field. Filling in for Ben Zobrist at second base yesterday, getting as Zobrist was given the day off. Zobrist did see a brief bit of action today. But Baez has been absolutely phenomenal. 2 plays in particular yesterday, a diving catch, robbing Dodgers of a what should have been a nice single up the middle, and then a nice glove flip to first base on a very slow grounder, getting the ball on target to Anthony Rizzo in time for the out. Joe Maddon gushed about Baez's performance after the win against the Dodgers yesterday.
You know, he timed it perfectly, the dive, etc. He has the knack for the spectacular. He's got that. How about the flip on the slow roller? Not many guys could do that well and that accurately. He set himself a wonderful day, man, and then the homer. And that was a big play in the game. That was a really big play. He had himself a wonderful day, and again, this is just the beginning for him. I like the fact that when he's not playing, he's ready to play. He's in the moment. You can see in his face he's happy. He gets it, and he knows his time's coming.
That's Cubs skipper Joe Maddon talking about Javier Baez. I like that phrase he dropped, a knack for a knack for the spectacular. Just 22 starts for Baez, as you heard Maddon mention the fact that he's not always playing, but he's always ready to play. 22 starts, including today's, in 53 games for the Cubs on the season. And it's because, simply, the Cubs are that deep. But he's Joe Maddon's go-to guy, his Swiss Army knife, if you will, in the field. Similar to the way that Joe Maddon used Ben Zobrist when the two were together with the Tampa Bay Rays back in the day. Baez has played literally all over the place. Left field, third base, shortstop, second base, even filling in at first base when Anthony Rizzo needs the occasional day off. This Kyle Schwarber injury was a heartbreaker for Cubs fans, a really tough way to start the season. But his injury and his absence has really increased the playing time for Baez, particularly when Chris Bryant is needed out there in left field. And Baez can play third, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We're seeing him fill in at second for Zobrist, filling in for Addison Russell at short. He's playing all over the place. The funny thing is, I mean, the All-Star voting is a little ridiculous. And the All-Star fan voting, where the Cubs could literally field the entire infield for the National League All-Stars. That's the way the voting is looking right now. So Baez is basically the backup for an all-star at every infield position for the Cubs. That's the way it's looking anyway. And Maddon, as you heard him say, just getting started, Javier Baez. You have to imagine he is going to be a huge piece for the Cubs down the stretch. And he isn't shying away from this position of being a versatile role player, happy to play wherever he is needed. Even more impressive than the individual efforts of Javi Baez recently is the collective effort of the Cubs starting rotation, which has been just on fire. Arrieta had 7 clean innings in the second game of that Dodgers series, which unfortunately for Cubs fans broke that series, that streak of 23 straight wins for the Cubs when Jake Arrieta starts dating back to last July, But it wasn't Arrieta's fault. Seven clean innings, including a dramatic seventh getting out of a bases-loaded jam. But then the Cubs bullpen gives up five runs over the eighth and ninth innings, and the Cubs only lost to the Dodgers. John Lester, 13th career complete game on Wednesday. After giving up a home run in the first inning, he shut the Dodgers down, striking out 10 and walking nobody. Giving up four hits, but wow. Great effort from John Lester there. According to Joe Maddon, it's the best he's seen from Lester in a Cubs jersey.
I really think that might have been the best I've seen Johnny since he's been here. He maintained his velocity throughout, his strike throwing throughout. His cutter was 91 in the ninth inning. Curveball had depth to it. Definitely repeated his delivery over and over. Gives up a leadoff homer and then just nothing.
The leadoff homer and then just nothing. Nice praise there for Lester from Joe Maddon. Lester lowered his ERA to 2.29 on the season. That is the sixth best in the National League. And his 1.02 whip is ninth. And he was talking after his complete game victory about carrying his portion of the load when he's seeing such stellar performances around him in this Cubs rotation.
Trying to pick up my load, you know, as far as my spot in the rotation and keep this train moving with these four other guys that are throwing the heck out of the ball right now. So that's the biggest thing, is just keep this line moving for the next guy. And it seems like every night we do a good job, keep our team in the ball game.
That's Cubs pitcher John Lester after his complete game victory, talking about picking up his load, carrying his load among all of these great Cubs starters. Share the load. Slow-mo Samwise Gamgee. Great performance from him. Carrying his share of the load and then some with that performance. And yesterday, Kyle Hendricks went eight innings, just two earned runs on three hits, struck out six, walked one. And really the impressive thing with Hendricks, that's his game, is getting batters to ground out. He's not a big strikeout guy, but the Dodgers are a flyball team. They hit a lot of deep balls, but Hendricks got them to ground out 12 times yesterday in eight innings. Hendricks is whipped down to 0.92. It's actually third best in the National League, just 0.03 of a point worse than Jake Arrieta, his teammate, and trailing Clayton Kershaw of the Dodgers in first. The third best whip in the NL for Kyle Hendricks. A great compliment to this Cubs rotation. Very strong start to the season for him. He was perhaps, along with Jason Hamill, after Hamill's poor second half of last season, the question marks behind Arrieta, Lester, and Lackey. Hendricks talked about how this groove that the Cubs starting rotation is in can be somewhat contagious.
It's definitely contagious when guys are doing well, but there's definitely competitiveness as well, friendly competition. I think it fuels all of us. You know, we see one guy go out there and dominate, the next one right next in line wants to go do it. We just got a lot of good competitors in the rotation, and when everybody's pitching well, it makes it fun.
And everybody pitching well. Maddon loved the performance from Hendricks yesterday. Really, you look at Hendricks' last two starts, his start prior to this one yesterday, he threw a complete game. And then followed that up with eight full innings. First time in Hendricks' career that he went back-to-back starts going at least eight innings. Nice accomplishment for him there. And Joe Maddon is thinking not just about giving him kudos for yesterday, but thinking, all right, well, now we know that Kyle Hendricks can do this and expect more of this season.
He knows he can do it now. I mean, and that really matters. For the most part this year, we were going like five, six plus with him, maybe a seven. But the other day was the perfect opportunity to let him go more deeply into the game. We had to. He's just pitching that well. So now he comes out today knowing that he can do that. Hot day, really good lineup, a lot of lefties. So to be able to navigate that lineup as well as he did speaks to how well he's pitching right now.
I feel like this was a key moment in the building relationship between Joe Maddon and Kyle Hendricks, one of his starters. Because many times throughout last season, we saw Hendricks get really frustrated, visibly frustrated when he would get yanked early by Maddon in a game when, by all accounts, he was pitching fairly well. But Maddon would give him the hook after the fifth inning, sometimes even the fourth inning. it sounds like now with these back-to-back starts of a complete game and then eight innings following that up, Joe Maddon might be letting that leash a little bit looser. And Kyle Hendricks clearly thinks he's ready for this kind of work, and now apparently his manager does too.
I don't think you're ready yet, man.
I'm ready to ride Giants, Kunu. I think you're ready.
The other question mark for the Cubs right now, Jason Hamill, who left after just two innings in the opener against the Dodgers. Turns out it was just cramps. Of course, the big worry with him was the hamstring injury from last season. After that hamstring, he did not look like himself, really struggled down the stretch. But it apparently was not a re-injury there, just some cramps. And he is expected to be ready to go for his start in the rotation tomorrow. So good news there for Hamill. And then Lackey today, 6 2/3, 9 strikeouts, no runs allowed. I mean, all five in this Cubs rotation right now, getting the job done. So what is it with all this talk? Fans, media, people on the radio, talking about the Cubs and Theo Epstein looking to add a pitcher, a starting pitcher, to this Cubs rotation before the trade deadline. Understand what people are talking about.
What the fuck are you talking about, man?
Why? Cubs starters have three of the top six ERAs in the National League, Arrieta, Hamill, and Lester. Cubs starters have three of the top six and four of the top 10 in WHIP in the National League, Arrieta, Hendricks, Lackey, and Lester. All five are accounted for in these incredible stats. Collectively, the Cubs starters, 2.38 ERA on the year, and this is, these stats are from yesterday before today's game, but hey, a fat zero for Lackey over 6 2/3 will certainly help these numbers. Collectively, 2.38 ERA for the Cubs, best in the National League. The Nationals' collective rotation is second with a 3.06 ERA, way behind the Cubs. And their .199 batting average collectively, also best in the National League. The Dodgers' starting rotation is second behind them at .221. And the Cubs just won 3 of 4 against those very same Dodgers. I'd say that rotation is pretty good.
Pretty good.
I don't know if it's just people already looking forward to the deadline because they're antsy, because the Cubs are doing really well. And if we reach the deadline, then that's a checkpoint of this season, and hopefully things are going just as well by then. Or are people expecting one of our five starters to get injured, knock on wood, between now and the deadline? Are you really looking to replace one of these guys? I feel like everybody needs to chill on this talk.
All right, everyone, chill.
I mean, yes, it's always nice to have options, but the Cubs starters are 31-10. This rotation is winning. This rotation seems to have this nice collective chemistry. Lester talking about picking up the slack, making sure his performance is on par with his teammates. Hendricks saying there's a contagiousness to how well they're all pitching, and also a friendly competitiveness within them in the clubhouse. I mean, this all seems to be a good thing, and sure, you might be able to find somebody at deadline who is a big name pitcher, perhaps is like a top two or three guy on his squad to add into the Cubs behind Arrieta, Lester, Lackey. But I mean, do you want to replace Jason Hamill and Kyle Hendricks the way they're pitching right now? Doesn't make any sense to me. Maybe some Cubs fans with their lifelong pessimism are already waiting for the other shoe to drop for Hendricks or for Hamill. Some still not convinced that Lester is worth the money that we gave him. But what are you going to do? Take Lester out of your rotation? No. The Cubs and their starters are just going to keep on trucking while people are talking. Cubs keep on trucking. Another win today, 6-0 over the Diamondbacks. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll look at these NBA finals. Game one last night went to the Warriors. Do the Cavs and their quote-unquote defense have a chance to turn things around? 347-327-9183 is the number. You're listening to Chi-Town Chatter with Matt Peck on Blog Talk Radio. Stick around.
I'll be right back. Don't you go dying on me.
I love you.
Oh, that's so nice. Really?
I made these for you. They're just brownies.
Could I have one?
Go ahead.
No.
What? You don't like brownies?
No.
I'm sorry. I can't understand you.
No.
Mick?
No.
You're seeing someone else.
No.
A guy named Mick.
No.
I can't believe this.
No.
Hey, my name is Scott.
No.
Hey, Scott, look.
No.
I gotta go. I hope Mick likes brownies.
Got milk. Brought to you by America's Dairy Farmers.
Nothing's funny about gout flares. Though they can make you walk funny, or sport that hilarious open-toed sneaker of yours. Those are serious attempts to live with gout flares. But why live with them? Visit gout.com and find better ways to fight flares over time.
Budweiser commercial featuring the crew cut.
Where there's life, there's fun. At a concert or a show, in your own backyard, wherever you go, Budweiser's here, and for folks to know where it's live. There's Budweiser.
Welcome back to Chi-Town Chatter on Blog Talk Radio. Matt Peck hanging out with you on Friday evening as we get closer to kickoff between USA and Colombia in the first game of the Copa America Centenario. But right now, we're talking NBA Finals. Before we get to this year's finals, we have to celebrate a particular anniversary. On this day, June 3rd, 1992, the infamous Michael Jordan shrug. After his sixth made three-pointer in the first half of Game 1, the NBA Finals against the Portland Trail Blazers. His sixth made threes and his 35 points in the first half both set NBA records. Wonderful memory. Incredible performance from MJ, one of several. The shrug. 24 years ago today. Happy anniversary, MJ. Happy anniversary, Bulls fans. Seems like anniversaries of the dynasty are really the only positive things for Bulls fans these days. Well, you can talk to the NBA Finals that are happening and choose a side, because there's always more than that way. Coming into these NBA Finals, both teams had to do the media day dance that so many professional athletes hate. Before Game 1, lots of LeBron and Steph talk being thrown around. Who's the face of the league? Has Curry surpassed LeBron? Is Curry more likable than LeBron? Yada, yada, yada. Well, another one of the interesting questions that LeBron had to answer was this question about whether or not he's concerned with the finals losses that have been piling up for him, entering his sixth straight finals appearance and his seventh overall. Here's what LeBron had to say.
Everything I've done has been a success. So, you know, as far as the game of basketball, I just go out and play it and have fun and love it and give and be true to the game and to my teammates and live with the results. So it don't really get to me too much.
Really, LeBron? Really? Doesn't get to you? It's gotta be kinda nagging at you. Worrying you just a little bit, given the finals record. And before Game 1, all sorts of people wrote all sorts of columns on both sides of the fence about LeBron and his 2-for-6 record in the NBA Finals. So I'm saying, hey, he's been to 7 NBA Finals now. In the previous 6, he's won 2 of them. Going to 6 straight NBA Finals is an incredible accomplishment all in itself. And the other saying, well, yes, I guess, but he lost 4 of them. Others pointing out, myself included, that when you get to six straight NBA finals coming from the Eastern Conference, given what the Eastern Conference has been in the prime of LeBron's career, I feel like it's not all that impressive. And I just don't buy it, what LeBron is saying. Either he's lying or he's truly not a great competitor, which he has also been accused of being. But as much as I rag on him, I want to say he's lying, and I don't believe him that this kind of worry of his finals record doesn't matter to him.
I'm on right now. I don't believe you.
Don't believe you, LeBron. You really don't care about losing? It's just basketball? I mean, it's such a cop-out answer. It's such a cop-out talk. And it's something that I don't think you would ever hear Michael Jordan say, just throwing it out there. LeBron has been criticized throughout his career for not having that killer instinct because he doesn't take over late in games, in important games, as frequently as players like MJ did. And there are others who argue, well, he's more of a distributor like Magic Johnson. But Magic Johnson, well, he had that killer instinct too, I think. Either way, Steph Curry has been sitting back and listening to all of these LeBron people who have an opinion one way or the other, hate him or love him. Steph's just sitting there thinking, I don't really care about these comparisons between me and LeBron right now.
It's really annoying for me to kind of be, that's not what I'm playing for, to be the face of the NBA, to be this or that, or to take LeBron's throne or whatever. I'm trying to chase rings, and that's all I'm about. So that's where the conversation stops for me.
Chasing rings is all that matters. So says Steph Curry coming into these NBA finals. And clearly team wins have meant more for all of the Warriors players this season than any individual labels or accolades. And that was definitely the case in last night's game one, as Steph Curry scored just 11 points on 4 of 15 shooting. The other Splash brother, Klay Thompson, 9 points on 4 of 12. It was the Warriors bench who showed up big, particularly when things looked like they were about to get out of hand for the Warriors. Here's their coach, Steve Kerr, after the game.
You know, we came out after halftime and we completely lost focus and throwing careless passes. We got lost defensively a couple of times, and we had to kind of regain our focus and our edge, and the bench did that for us, so they did a great job.
That was part of Steve Kerr's answer to the question, why did you shatter your clipboard into a million pieces, which you could see Kerr doing during a timeout that was televised. But he was right. The Warriors came out a little bit flat to start the second half, but their bench got things going. Andre Iguodala, who of course was the finals MVP last year, primarily for his defense on LeBron James, started in Game 7 against OKC in the Western Conference Finals, but then Harrison Barnes was given his starting spot back in Game 1 last night. Iguodala, a big factor off the bench, 12.7 rebounds, 6 assists, most of the way to a triple-double. Leandro Barbosa, 11 points on a perfect 5 of 5 from the field, and Sean Livingston, a great story. An Illinois guy, NBA career, could have been lost a long time ago, but has made this great comeback story. Sean Livingston off the bench with 20 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. As the Warriors bench outscored the Cavs bench 45-10. Here's Livingston after the game.
Just being aggressive. It's what we did all year. You know, Andre was great. Barbosa was great tonight. And, we just feed off of each other and we just play well.
Really, those keys to the game on the Warriors bench. Barbosa, Iguodala, and Livingston, 3 old vets. And this Warriors team, you sometimes with all of the talk about Steph and to a second degree Klay Thompson and to a second or third degree Draymond Green with not only his basketball ability but his building Dennis Rodman-esque personality and his flair for the dramatic, you sometimes forget just how deep this Warriors team is. Beyond the starting five, their bench is filled with NBA veterans who have talent, who have poise in crunch time situations. Now, LeBron James was asked after this game one loss if this was a new challenge this year, because it's more than just trying to guard Klay Thompson and Steph Curry. Here's LeBron's answer.
I think you're wrong in the fact of saying it was just Clay and Steph. I mean, they got to the point where they were last year and won a championship because of their whole team and their bench. And they're here once again in the finals because of their whole team. So, you know, nothing has really changed. They're a team that's had another year under their belt, and they've exceeded what they did last year.
I love the beginning of his answer. I think you're wrong. But LeBron is right there. It was clearly not a two-man team. Because of that, because of what we saw last night, the production from all over the floor from the Warriors offense, which this isn't a surprise. Yes, Klay was deadly in that series against OKC, really saved the Warriors when they were down 3-1. Steph, two-time reigning MVP. Incredible things that he's doing that we have never seen before. But this Warriors team was a deep, well-rounded team last year, and they are again this year. And the Cavs are in trouble. You look at some of the things that the Cavs managed to do last night. They out-rebounded the Warriors by 6. They doubled the Warriors in fast break points, 18-9. They doubled them in free throw attempts, 20-10. Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, the backcourt, the best backcourt in the league right now. Some are saying, when it's all said and done, could be the best backcourt in NBA history, combined for only 20 points, and the Cavs still lost. It does not bode well for them.
We are screwed.
Hey, no, hey, I don't want to hear that defeatist attitude. I want to hear you upbeat. We are screwed.
Some frowns in the Cavs locker room last night, and either LeBron or their coach Tyronn Lue trying to give people a smile instead of a frown. I don't want to hear that. We're not lost yet. Somebody, J.R. Smith. We're screwed! I can picture it. But speaking of Cavs coach Tyronn Lue, who took over midseason after David Blatt was fired, he spoke before these finals began about the key for his Cavs team winning this series, winning the title. Here's what he had to say.
The biggest thing for me, I just think we got to be aggressive. I think we got to be aggressive attacking those guys on the offensive end. We can't settle for quick jump shots and bail those guys out and let them get down in early transition and getting threes in the Oracle Arena, because it's going to go crazy when they make threes. So just being, we want to push the pace. We want to play fast, but not in a hurry.
That's Cavs coach Tyronn Lue talking about his offense being aggressive and smart. Push the pace, but don't hurry ourselves. Don't let the Warriors get out and transition off of bad shots. The Cavs team is a rematch. In other ways, it's not a rematch at all from last year. The Cavs are a completely different team. Yes, they have a healthy Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving, which they did not last year. But they also changed their style to sort of match what the Warriors are doing. Pace and space, completely eliminating the presence of Timothy Mozgov. Adding Channing Frye at the deadline, more three-point shooting, spreading the floor with Kevin Love, who really seemed to find his niche with his team down the stretch. And that's what the Cavs tried to do. Tyronn Lue, with his thoughts on what his team needed to accomplish to control this series, he's trying to beat the Warriors at their own game. And I just don't think that is a good strategy. The Cavs swept two garbage teams in the East and then were tied 2-2 with the Raptors and then dispatched them in 6. Those three series collectively does not prepare the Cavs for the Warriors. They looked woefully underprepared last night. It didn't help that the Cavs shot the three ball so well through the first three rounds. I think that did them a disservice, because they won't outshoot the Warriors from three. They just won't. Kevin Love, J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert, Channing Frye, all these guys that the Cavs have that shoot the three ball are all streaky. They've been shooting it really well in the playoffs, but that's not really... I doubted that they could keep up that pace. And they shot 33% from downtown last night. Not terrible. But if that's how they're going to try to beat the Warriors, for their own sake, actually also shot exactly 33% last night. So you didn't beat them there. Warriors 33% actually came with more threes made. And this is what the Warriors do. And the sad, depressing thing, if you're a Cavs fan, is that that's just part of what the Warriors do. They move the ball, and we saw that last night. 29 assists on 43 made baskets. And your stars combined for only 20 points. Yet your team scored 104. Unselfish basketball that the Cavs cannot defend. Tyronn Lue spoke about not letting the Warriors hit threes in transition, and really the only time he mentioned defense was when it was a one-off of talking about his offense and not taking bad shots. Actually playing defense, Tyronn Lue. Kevin Love can't guard a living thing. Kyrie Irving, your very talented point guard, whose presence is a huge factor in this series, 26 points, including 11 made free throws last night, but he can't guard for shit. Cannot guard Steph Curry. Steph Curry just had Russell Westbrook hounding the shit out of him for 7 games. Kyrie Irving must feel like a nice light summer breeze for Curry if he's coming off screens or trying to beat Kyrie off the dribble. It's easy. J.R. Smith, not a great wing defender. Last night, the Cavs were just chasing the Warriors and failing miserably.
It's like watching a bunch of cars trying to get a doorknob out there.
It wasn't pretty. The real problem for the Cavs, amidst all this talk about Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving being back and this team being better because of it, and the Cavs having a much greater shot at beating the Warriors this time around, look, the Warriors looked vulnerable against the Thunder, down 3-1. Many thought they were toast, and I think the Thunder actually did them a favor because the Thunder sort of gave the Warriors a reminder that they can't be careless with the basketball, which they were in some of those losses against the Thunder. Last night, only 9 turnovers compared to 17 for the Cavs. The Thunder reminded the Warriors that they have to play defense occasionally because the Warriors were giving up 130-plus to the Thunder. And last night they held the Cavs to 38% shooting and 89 points. The Cavs team that has been averaging 106 points per game in the playoffs until they met the Warriors. This combination of factors to me just spells doom for the Cavs. Although they are likely to respond with a better effort in Game 2, if no other reason than LeBron James. LeBron loses game ones all the time, loses game ones like it's his job. He calls them feel-out games all the time. And I guess whenever he's in a situation that he's trying to feel out, he loses that situation. LeBron is 1-6 in NBA Finals game ones in the 7 times he's been there. 1-6. But over the course of his playoff career, LeBron is 9-0 in game two of a series when his team loses game one. Talk about bouncing back. Two of those, by the way, would be the Bulls in the conference finals in 2011 and the Bulls in the conference semis in 2013. So, no, LeBron and the Cavs are not entirely dead, and you can expect a gigantic performance from LeBron on Sunday.
I'm not dead. What? Nothing is, you know. I'm not dead.
Yeah. He says he's not dead.
Yes, he is.
I'm not.
He isn't? Well, he will be soon. He's very ill.
I'm getting better.
No, you're not. You'll be stone dead in a moment.
Let's not forget that the Cavs actually took a 2-1 series lead in the finals against the Warriors last year after losing game one. Could we see them steal home court again on Sunday? I just don't have faith in their defensive abilities. Or their offensive versatility. Sometimes we see this Cavs team, the ball gets stuck offensively. And if guys aren't hitting their shots and LeBron is asked to do everything, this Cavs team can get bogged down. They can get frustrated. You already saw LeBron with some mounting frustration on the sideline last night as his team managed to claw their way back and actually take a 1-point lead in the third quarter and then get run off the floor by the Warriors bench. I think the Cavs are in trouble. And that leads me to the question of, should that make Bulls fans happy? Should Bulls fans be rooting for the Warriors or for the Cavs? To those Bulls fans who are rooting for the Cavs, reason being to protect the 96 Bulls title as the greatest team ever in NBA history, I say to you, stop it.
You are so dumb. You are really dumb. For real.
What an idiot.
You are literally too stupid to insult.
Are you kidding me? Who the hell in their right mind as a Bulls fan is pulling for LeBron and the Cavs? What, so that the Warriors can lose and we can still make a claim as 96 being the best team ever? Look, that's not even set in stone. I mean, a lot of people have that opinion, most of them Bulls fans, some of them not. But there are other teams further back than the Bulls in history that also stake claim to that argument. None of them won 72-10, but if the Warriors join that conversation by winning this title and having a regular season record of 73-9, so what? Good for them. Congratulations. It's still going to be an ongoing conversation that will never have a concrete winner being chased by several losers. One game, one more regular season win, and also already one more collective regular season and playoff record loss than the 72-10 Bulls. You're splitting hairs. You're splitting decades. You're splitting NBA generations. The game is different. It's all conjecture for the fun of NBA fans to talk about. Who cares about that? Whereas, gee, LeBron James, Bulls fans, is our enemy. Right now, in the present, LeBron is our enemy. He's knocked out the Bulls four times in the last seven seasons. Hit a dagger in Game 4 just two seasons ago. Actually, I mean, really, this is like this time last year. A dagger in Game 4 on the United Center floor to even the series, swing the momentum back towards Cleveland. Eliminated us. Derrick Rose's MVP seasons, one win against LeBron, then he swept us out. When you look at things that the Warriors have done to the Bulls, it's just like the 96 Bulls, and just like the other teams in the great debate of greatest team ever, it's in the past. The 75 Warriors beat the 75 Bulls in the Western Conference Finals when the Bulls had a 3-2 lead. Warriors won Game 6, won Game 7. Small potatoes in the past. This season, Bulls gave the Warriors a fair fight in Oakland, actually, and then got stomped at home. Who cares about that? LeBron is our enemy now. LeBron will be our enemy until they beat him, until he retires or until he dies, whichever happens first. But LeBron is the enemy now in the present. And don't give me some sob story. Usually I love David Haw, the writer for The Trib, but he wrote this article about Chicago fans and Bulls fans. It's time to embrace LeBron and the Cavs because it would be a great sports story. Cleveland, the city, ending their championship drought. I'm sorry, David Haw, but I disagree with you on this one. No. Who the hell cares about Cleveland's championship drought? The Cubbies are trying to end their own, and it's more than twice as long as the city of Cleveland. This is Chicago, goddammit. Why should we care about Cleveland? Who the hell cares about Cleveland? I leave you with the wise words of a young Joakim Noah.
I just stayed in my hotel room, man. Every time I look out my window, it's pretty depressing out here, man. It's bad. It's bad. No going on in Cleveland, man. It's all factories.
Do you regret anything that you said about Cleveland?
Not at all. You like it? You think Cleveland's cool? I mean, I never heard anybody say, I'm going to Cleveland on vacation. What's so good about Cleveland?
What's so good about Cleveland? As long as LeBron is there and eliminating the Bulls, and as long as RG3 is their quarterback, I'm going to go ahead and say my answer to that question is nothing. And I couldn't care less. Cleveland sob story, don't care. LeBron James, hate him. Hate him with a passion that makes my blood boil when I say his name, and I'm only slightly exaggerating. So why the hell, if you are a true diehard, see red, bleed red Bulls fan, would you want him to win this series and win this championship? Root for the Warriors. Or don't, but that's what I'll be doing. NBA Finals, Game 2, Sunday night in Oakland. Let's take one more time out, back to wrap up with a look at the U.S. men's national team, their roster, and the competition in Copa America that kicks off tonight, 30 Central Time. 347-327-9183. You're listening to Chi-Town Chatter with Matt Peck on Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 hours till dinner and I'm starving. So hungry I could eat a horse. Covered in milk, chocolate, peanuts, caramel, and nougat. Whoa! Hold your horses. What I really need is a Snickers, packed to the max with peanuts and caramel. Snickers really satisfies.
25,000 mornings, give or take, is all we humans get. We spend them on treadmills, spend them in traffic. And if we get lucky, really lucky, it dawns on us to go spend them in a world where a simple sunrise can still be magic. 25,000 mornings. Make sure some of them are pure Michigan. Your trip begins at Michigan.org.
Hey, it's me, Water. Did you know that if you filter me from your tap, I'm pretty much the same as I am in a plastic bottle? Except that I'm 10 times cheaper. Other than that, I'm pretty similar. Oh, and I'm fresher when I'm filtered. And I don't need an expiration date. And I don't have to get shipped halfway around the world. But other than that, we're pretty much the same. Pure Water Filter. A better source.
Hello. Ignition, hot and fresh out the kitchen. Mama rolling that body, got every man in here wishing. Sipping on coke and rum, I'm like, so what, I'm drunk. It's the freaking weekend, baby, I'm about to have me some fun.
Bounce, 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 bounce.
Welcome back to Chi-Town Chatter on Blog Talk Radio. Matt Peck here with you Friday night. So we are less than 2 hours from kickoff between the U.S. and Colombia. And the first game of the Copa America Centenario. Biggest tournament the U.S. will play between the 2014 and 2018 World Cups, if you're talking about the level of competition. The U.S. did well in their friendlies preparing for this tournament, including 1-0 win over Ecuador and a 4-0 win over Bolivia last week. This is a key tournament for the U.S. men and their head coach, Jurgen Klinsmann. After that embarrassing disappointment losing to Jamaica in the semis of the Gold Cup last summer, Klinsmann and his team could really use a strong showing here. And this tournament is all about the youth movement.
So you're trying to push the next generation through, and they need to be, you know, aggressive enough to steal the spots from the older ones. And the older ones right now, they hang in there and they defend their spots. And it's the job of the younger guys to become more dominant, to become more aggressive, and to really go for it. And so hopefully we see in this Copa America some youngsters to step it up and to push them out.
That's U.S. men's head coach Jurgen Klinsmann talking about the generational gap that exists on his current roster and the challenge of the younger guys to come in and take the spots of the veterans. I believe there are somewhere around a dozen, maybe 14 or so holdovers from the U.S. squad from the 2014 World Cup on this 23 that he's taking to Copa America. And when asked if this would be the 23 in Russia in 2 years, Klinsmann said yes. Some of the older veterans that he was discussing, you got Chris Wondolowski up top at age 33, Jermaine Jones and Kyle Beckerman in the midfield, both 34, Clint Dempsey up top, 33, Tim Howard in goal is 37, sounding ancient, but he is actually taking a back seat to Brad Guzan, starting in net for the U.S. in this tournament. Guzan getting his real first chance to shine as goalkeeper one for the U.S. He's just 31. The U.S. will be without star striker Jozy Altidore, who is nursing a hamstring injury. And it will give an opportunity for some of the new guys, for some of the newer guys up top to contribute. Klinsmann has been known to shake things up when it comes to who he starts and where his starters play compared to their natural positions. He's always looking to shake it up.
Yeah, why not? Sure. Go ahead. Live a little. Come on, shake it up. Shake it in. Shake it up.
The question for Klinsmann and for U.S. soccer fans in this tournament is, how much will he shake it up when it comes to giving minutes, particularly to some of these younger kids like Bobby Wood, Darlington Nagbe, Christian Pulisic? These kids are all very dangerous, especially in the attack, the attacking third for the U.S. And they showed that late in these friendly games against Ecuador and Bolivia. Ecuador game looked like it was going to be a 0-0 draw, and late, I think it was 86th or 87th minute, Bobby Wood and Darlington Nagbe hook up for the game-winning goal.
Paredes' header is not the greatest one. Nagbe, great chance to win it. That's what he's done with his first goal for the USA. Darlington Nagbe and the USA might have grabbed the win right at the end.
That's Ian Dark on the call. Nagbe, a fairly late sub, coming in and making a difference, getting a header of an assist from Bobby Wood. Two youngsters looking to make a name for themselves in this tournament, getting the job done in that friendly win over Ecuador. And then the final tally and the dominant 4-0 win over Bolivia a few days later, a beautiful give-and-go between Nagbe and a veteran midfielder Jermaine Jones. And then Nagbe gets the give-and-go back, sets up a beautiful square pass right across the edge of the box to Christian Pulisic, who did not waste his opportunity.
Nagbe rides the challenge. Nagbe for Jones. Darlington Nagbe. Is he going to set up Christian Pulisic, the youngest American in the modern era of the U.S. national team, to score a goal?
At age 17, Pulisic, the youngest ever scorer for the U.S. men's national team. At just 17 years of age, he already has been picked up by Dortmund in Bundesliga. And these friendlies getting ready for Copa are the first real look I'd gotten at him, and boy, am I impressed. He is an absolute pest when the U.S. do not have the ball. He is putting constant pressure. And when it's his turn to make a play with that ball, receiving passes, dribbling, making passes, he is so calm and composed. That's the thing. Even as much as his tactical skill thus far, from what I've watched, composure when he is on the ball. And that, to me, stands out for a kid who's just 17 years old. And Klinsmann talked about Pulisic having no fear whatsoever.
He's a wonderful kid. He's grounded. He knows that he has a long way to go. But he has no fear, and this is very important, you know, not having fear, especially when you play then in our region, when it becomes really physical. And what you're going to see next Friday will be very, very physical.
That's the question for the young 17-year-old stud. Will he be able to compete when that physical ante is upped in a real tournament? Colombia, a very physical team, that's on deck tonight. Will he get in there? Will Pulisic get in there? What about Darlington Nagbe? Can they match the physicality and intensity of this tournament? Challenging some of the older midfielders. There are a lot of veteran midfielders on this U.S. squad, Beckerman and Jones included. And some of these kids are looking at them right now saying, okay, Klinsmann wants us to challenge you guys. We can play. What do you old guys have left in the tank? And speaking of old guys getting pushed out of the U.S. team, Landon Donovan spoke about the U.S. men's upcoming Copa competition and the expectations for Klinsmann's group. Here's what he had to say.
In tournaments like this, we need to advance out of our group. I think when you play in a World Cup, when you play in a Confederations Cup, when you play in a Copa Centenario, you need to advance out of your group. Now, when you play in a Gold Cup, the expectation is to win. Obviously, it's difficult. There's teams in their group that are very good teams. Costa Rica is going to be even a team that people probably still don't know a ton about, going to be a very good matchup. So it's going to be difficult, but I think if the U.S. play well, they should advance.
That's perhaps the most famous, the most decorated soccer player in U.S. history, Landon Donovan, who just had to get that jab in about the U.S. not winning the Gold Cup. Obviously, Landon Donovan still a little perturbed, upset, grudge-holding with Jurgen Klinsmann, who, amid lots of skepticism and criticism of soccer fans and soccer journalists here in the U.S., was left off of the roster for the 2014 World Cup. Donovan is right. This is a tough group that the U.S. have drawn. Colombia ranked fourth in the world. Costa Rica, another, certainly not a gimme. Paraguay really ranked right there with the U.S. as far as world ranking, late, you know, high 20s. So that might be the one, not a gimme game, but the easiest game of the three. And I have confidence in the U.S. in the midfield. It's a good balance of experience and youth and speed. And especially if Klinsmann lets Michael Bradley play that defensive mid spot where he played in these friendlies, where I believe he is most comfortable and most useful. Bradley's been never been much of a finisher up top, but he is so great at gaining possession in the defensive third and starting the U.S. and their possession and their attack with a smart pass or a series of smart passes while they're looking to create space. That is what Bradley is great at, and I feel like he does it best at that defensive mid. So if he stays there, I feel really good about the U.S. mids collectively. And there's dangerous speed on the wing. Really looking forward to see DeAndre Yedlin play in this tournament. The question is where. Sometimes Klinsmann plays him as a left fullback, and sometimes he lets him journey a bit forward as a left wing attacking mid of sorts. And then up top, plenty of weapons. I mentioned Nagby and Pulisic. Jossie Zardes, another great weapon. He had two goals against Bolivia in that friendly. He has been on form. A couple of bad touches. He's been known to have struggles with his first touch. Not always great at settling the ball when he gets it in dangerous positions on the field. But he looked great in these tune-ups. It's all about the defense for the U.S. It's been the problem for years. It will be the problem in this tournament if there is a problem. Can they avoid simple mental errors on their back line? Jeff Cameron and John Brooks expecting to play some in that middle, anchoring that defense, and they have had problems. And that seems to be one of the keys for this U.S. team coming into this tournament. And John Brooks in particular, well, Klinsmann singled him out when he was asked about three key players at each level of this U.S. team in the tournament.
Defender, probably John Brooks. Midfielder, we hope for Darling Nnapi making the next step, pushing through. Forward, I think Bobby Wood can break through in this Copa America.
That's Klinsmann. We already covered Nagby and Wood, who actually hooked up for the one and only goal against Ecuador. They look to be on the cusp of a great showing here. But John Brooks and Klinsmann went on to really call him out and say, yes, this is a 23-year-old kid. He's entering his prime. And he was a staple for us in the 2014 World Cup at just 19 years of age. Or no, I guess he was 21. But he needs to take a step back, polishing his game. And yes, I mean, we all remember two summers ago that John Brooks goal that will probably live in U.S. soccer lore for ages. That's once again Ian Dark on the call. John Brooks' late goal to give the U.S. men that 2-1 win over Ghana in the group stage in 2014. The hero in a redemption game against Ghana, who had been the U.S.'s foil in the 2010 World Cup. And John Brooks will always carry that with him on his resume, but his real job is to anchor this defense. this back line that has been so shaky at times and still makes silly mistakes. So, how will he fare? Matt Beisler, also a guy who Klinsmann likes to use frequently, but has been known to slip up. Never seems like these guys, communication-wise, on the U.S. back line, are on the same page. That will be their vulnerability in this tournament. And tonight is a real test. If you look back at the history between these two teams, U.S. and Colombia, the U.S. is overall record against Colombia all time, 3-10-4 draws. Last win for the U.S. came back in 2005, more than 10 years ago. Their last meeting, November 14, after the World Cup had concluded, the U.S. lost 2-1, Colombia getting a goal in the 87th minute. Soccer fans that have been soccer fans for a long time, yours truly included, will remember the 94 World Cup. Perhaps one of the most famous victories for the U.S. men's team, beating the heavily favored Colombians, that team that featured Carlos Valderrama, 2-1 in the group stage. Huge upset for the U.S. And then in 95, Copa America tournament, the third place game as both teams lost in their respective semifinals, Colombia routed the U.S. 4-1. Colombia has been playing well lately. In their World Cup qualifier games, they have 10 points through six matches. Of course, the big name for Colombia is James Rodriguez. Also, an interesting piece that will be playing up top along with him, a dangerous weapon, Carlos Bacca. Rodriguez had his coming out party in the World Cup in 2014. Six goals, won the Golden Boot Award, and was rewarded with a huge contract from Real Madrid, for whom he has 78 caps and 25 goals. Rodriguez is a phenom in his prime. And his teammate Bacca, who plays for AC Milan, 18 goals in 36 matches for him this season for AC Milan. He has three tallies in the net through six games of their World Cup qualifying. Dangerous, dangerous attackers. Rodriguez has lightning speed and really incredible footwork. And Bacca, well, he's just a great finisher. If the U.S. get out of this group, somehow, even if they don't beat Colombia, if they manage to draw Colombia, that'd be a great accomplishment, I think. If they can figure out a way to earn a victory over Paraguay, possibly Costa Rica, if they get out of this group, well, things could get interesting. Heavy favorites have to be Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, who could be waiting after the group stages, but there are some injuries and or absences to key players on those squads. Neymar not playing for Brazil. His club team, Barcelona, telling him you can play for Brazil in the Olympics, which will be in his native land in Rio this summer. You can play in those, but you can't play in Copa America, one or the other. So Neymar's out for Brazil. Lionel Messi suffered a rib injury in Argentina's last friendly to get ready for this tournament. His status is uncertain. Might miss the first game or two of group play, might be playing injured, could re-injure that rib and knock himself out of the tournament. And then Luis Suarez, this trio of the fact that these three guys that I just mentioned all play on the same team is fucking ridiculous. But Suarez for Uruguay, he pulled a hamstring and is expected to miss the group stage. Might be ready to come back if Uruguay makes it out of the group stage. Might miss the tournament altogether. If these three teams, in the absence or less than 100% health of these three stars, falter in the group stage, this tournament blows wide open. If the U.S. can get out of their group, this tournament could become a completely open ball game.
It's a whole new ball game. A whole new goddamn ball game.
So that's a look at the Colombian competition tonight. Injury updates for key players and some of the other favorites in this tournament. And the expectations for the U.S. men's national team. Really expecting, not quite demanding, but expecting them to get out of this group despite the very difficult presence of Colombia. And hey, why not just dive right into the deep end? Colombia and the U.S. tonight. That kickoff is in 90 minutes. We are 90 minutes away from the first 90 minutes of the Copa America tournament. We have reached and passed the 7 o'clock hour. That means I got to get out of here. Got to find myself a nice watch party with a lot of loud, drunk Americans screaming at this TV. Cannot wait. It's time for some soccer this summer. Hell yes. This has been Chi-Town Chatter on Blog Talk Radio. Matt Peck saying thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Go Cubs go, 9 out of the last 10. And most importantly, I believe that we will win.